Well, this morning in this hour of Focus 580, we will be talking about deregulation of the electric utility industry. For some time now, if you've been listening to the news and paying attention to the news, we've been hearing about the various difficulties that folks have been facing in the state of California with shortages and rolling blackouts. And officials have attributed much of this to the way that deregulation was handled in that state, which in turn caused people other places where they're talking about deregulation. This is one of them. That is this state, Illinois, we're in the process of deregulating, has led people other places around the country to ask some rather nervous questions about whether or not that could happen here. What we want to try to do this morning with our guest, Richard Hirsch, is talk a little bit about where we've come from and where we're going on the topic of regulation. A little bit about how it is that utility companies got to be regulated monopolies in the first place, and then some of the forces that came to bear on them, particularly in the 70s, that set the stage for deregulation, and then maybe talk a little bit about where things are headed over the next decade or so as this process continues. Our guest is a professor of history and of science and technology studies at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. And he's done a lot of writing on this subject. And I'll just name a recent book that you might want to look at if you'd like to read more about the subject. It's titled Power Loss: The Origins of Deregulation and Restructuring in the American Electric Utility System. It is published by the MIT Press. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be long-distance call for you, 800-222-9455. Professor Hirsch, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. Just to sort of set the stage for where we are now, I think your suggestion was, I think it was a good one, just to go back a little bit and talk about how it is we ended up with the utilities that we had on the eve of deregulation. I think in some of your writings, you look all the way back to the beginning and look at the first periods where then major markets, at least, there were competing entrepreneurs who were trying to set up systems to provide electricity to people. And what they found out was that they really needed to have as many customers as they possibly could have to be profitable. And that led to consolidation and takeovers and people going out of business to the point where we really came down to what were in effect monopolies. They were regulated monopolies, but they were monopolies nonetheless. But we, as a society, I guess, decided that in those particular cases that that was okay. And in the book Power Loss, you write about something that you call the utility consensus that said, well, all right, yes, they're monopolies, but we think that with proper controls, that's all right. How did we arrive at the point where we decided that, you know, we were down on monopolies in other industries, but as far as people providing electricity, we said, well, that's okay. Why did we decide that that was all right?
That's right. This country has a history of not liking monopolies, and yet in some circumstances, it seems that monopolies can provide better services to customers than if there were competition. We learned that in the railroad industry starting in the 1850s and 60s, where it just didn't seem to make sense to have two sets of railroad lines going parallel to each other to the same destinations. There were huge capital expenses in that industry, and as a matter of normal business, the competitors tended to work together, they bought each other out, whatever, and then you ended up with a de facto monopoly that could charge whatever it wanted. Regulation came in the 1870s and 80s in the railroad business to try and deal with a monopoly like the railroad industry that really wasn't serving customers very well because they could charge high rates. So regulation there came in to deal with an industry that was viewed as evil to make it so that it would be better for customers. Now, the electric utility industry was a little bit different, but there were parallels there. The electric utility industry essentially started in 1882. with Thomas Edison's power plant in New York City. Other competitors got into the business. They were supplying electricity to customers within cities, and eventually you started seeing the same thing. The companies realized that they could do better if they had larger numbers of customers. They could eliminate duplicate facilities, power plants, distribution lines, and the like. And by the 1890s, you started seeing de facto monopolies in the utility business as well. This is all during the progressive era of American history. You can go back to your high school textbooks and learn more about that. But basically, what you saw was an effort by some progressive politicians to regulate these monopolies. They were viewed as natural monopolies, meaning, again, that they would serve customers better if there were only one company producing electricity, producing those services, than if there were competitors. But as part of this progressive era movement, people realized that these monopolies had to be overseen by government so that they could not exploit their monopoly status like the railroad companies did. So in the early 1900s, a few states, especially New York and Wisconsin, started regulating these monopolies. But what really is interesting here is that many of the leaders of the utility industry wanted regulation. In fact, in your area, in Illinois, you had Samuel Insull, head of Commonwealth Edison, who sought regulation. And he sought regulation because he thought it would make utility companies look better in the public eye, but also that there were the very definite business benefits of regulation. Regulation would help stabilize the business and make the bond and stock offerings of these companies look more attractive to investors. So while regulation was somewhat imposed on the utility industry, it was different than the railroad industry because there were indeed many people in the industry who wanted regulation. And very quickly, regulation was meant to do two things. It was meant to help customers so that they wouldn't be exploited by monopoly companies, so that the monopoly companies couldn't charge whatever they wanted. But it was also designed to protect the utility companies. After all, the utilities were providing a necessary commodity, or a commodity that eventually became necessary, electric power, and it was in the interest, the public interest, to make sure that those companies stayed in business. So the utility regulators made sure that the rates were high enough to provide a profit to the utility companies and make sure those companies stayed solvent. And this, again, was one of the things that Insull looked forward to as a marketing device for investors. After all, investors like the notion that the company is somewhat protected, it's going to get guaranteed profits, and it's not going to go under. So it looked very nice. The utility consensus back in the early 1900s basically suggested that, or basically accepted the notion that utilities were natural monopolies, but that they needed regulation so that they would not exploit the monopoly status, but also to protect the utilities themselves.
Yeah.
And we see that that dual function of regulation that dual function of regulation continues throughout the 20th century and even up to the 21st century now. In California, obviously, you see customers getting upset at higher rates, and yet the regulators have to make sure that the companies stay in business. Otherwise, there's no electricity.
The utilities, for maybe about three-quarters of the last century, continued to do well. They grew, the customer base grew, they built bigger and bigger power plants. As a result, the cost of electricity to consumers steadily went down.
That's right.
Over that period. But when we get to the 70s, utility companies started to experience a number of significant problems. In part, I guess they realized that there was a point at which getting bigger didn't, you know, building bigger power plants and getting bigger was not going to benefit them. There was the energy crisis, which indeed did affect them in the 70s. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what sort of things were happening, large economic issues were happening at this point to cause so many difficulties for the industry.
Okay. You mentioned a very important point here. and I'll just put a little flesh on that. The electric utility industry seemed like a model regulated industry for almost three-quarters of the 20th century. The industry demonstrated decreasing prices, decreasing costs. And the major reason for that was because the standard generating technology of the industry, steam turbine generators, kept improving incrementally throughout the 20th century. They were able to produce more electricity using less fuel. There were associated improvements in transmission and distribution as well. And in fact, the cost of electricity throughout the first three quarters of the 20th century went down, and as the costs went down, prices went down. Just to give you an idea of how much costs went down, if you look at the inflation-adjusted price of electricity to a residential customer in 1892, that cost in 2001 terms would have been about $4.50 per kilowatt hour. The average residential price for electricity in the country now is about 8 to 9 cents per kilowatt hour. So you saw a decline of about 98% in the price of electricity. And the price today, actually, in adjusted terms, is pretty close to what it was in 1970 or so. Okay, so the price went down largely because of these technological changes. In the 1970s, there were some major problems. One major problem was that the standard technology stopped improving. There are a whole bunch of reasons for this, and in a previous book I discussed those reasons. The standard traditional technology simply stopped getting better. Technical and managerial reasons explain this. I won't go into that. So you have the technology no longer improving, and in the past, the improved technology mitigated price increases due to inflation or other reasons. So you don't have the new technology out there that's going to mitigate whatever is going to come along. And, of course, what came along in 1973 was the oil embargo and the first of a couple of energy crises. And the energy crisis of 1973 resulted in much higher oil prices and much higher prices for other fuels as well. Between October 1973 and January 1974, oil prices went up by a factor of four or so. And you saw oil prices going up a lot more throughout the 1970s. Oil was used a lot for generating electricity back then, and naturally the price of electricity went up too as the cost went up. So that was obviously a major problem. You mentioned the fact that these large power plants in the 1970s showed problems. Not only didn't they get more efficient, they got a lot more expensive to build. And the reason companies were building more power plants was because they expected the growth rate of electricity usage to increase as it had previously. Since World War II until the 1970s, the growth rate of electric consumption was about 7% per year. That means that every 10 years, usage doubles. That's a huge, very fast growth rate, much faster than the gross national product, much faster than any other fuel use. And part of the reason, of course, is because electricity is a very versatile type of energy. So you have this huge growth rate, or this huge anticipated growth rate. Companies were building these big power plants, and they were no longer cheap. They were very, very expensive. There were lots of problems, especially with nuclear power plants. So as these new power plants came online, there was extra pressure to raise the price of electricity. So you have fuel prices going up, and that's pressure to raise prices. You have these expensive power plants coming online, and that's more pressure for higher-priced electricity. And the utility commissions, the regulators, were in the middle, because you had customers saying, we don't want higher-priced electricity. You're supposed to protect us. And the utility companies are saying, if you don't give us higher prices, we're going to go bankrupt, and we're not going to be able to provide electricity. So those are some of the problems that you started seeing in the 70s. And in the 70s, I argue, you see the roots of deregulation forces in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. Well, I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus. We're speaking with Richard Hirsch. He's professor of history and of science and technology studies at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. And a major area of his teaching, research, and writing is electric utility deregulation. And I did mention one book, and he's done a lot of other writing on the subject. The book, if you're interested in delving into the subject in some depth, one book you might look at is titled Power Loss, The Origins of Deregulation and Restructuring in the American Electric Utility System, published by the MIT Press, and discusses some of the issues that we here have given you a thumbnail sketch of. The questions, of course, are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, as a result of the energy crisis of the 70s, this was during the Carter administration, the president, among other things, encouraged conservation, which I'm sure also put additional pressure on the electric utility companies because the demand for electricity went down. So that was an even greater problem for them. But one of the things that was interesting here that really set the stage for deregulation, and maybe in a way that wasn't really intended, this was sort of an unintended consequence, I think, was the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act of 1978.
Right.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about just how it is that this, what the results of this were and how this really started to lead a lot of people to question the idea of the regulated monopoly for the utility companies and whether, in fact, there was any real reason for that to continue.
Sure. The Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, affectionately known as PURPA, was one of President Carter's major legislative initiatives. In 1977, when he came into office, he wanted to reduce America's dependence on foreign oil. He didn't want to see the United States endure another energy crisis like in 1973. He had a big plan that he pushed onto Congress. Congress didn't like all the elements of the plan, but what one element that did come out of it, along with the five or four others, was this law, PURPA. PURPA was designed to streamline and to make more logical the types of rate structures that we have for paying for electricity. In other words, the rate structures that used to exist in many cases discouraged conservation and energy efficiency. They were designed to encourage people to use more electricity rather than less. That didn't seem to make sense to President Carter and his advisors, and part of the law was set up or designed to discourage these types of rate structures. But there was a tiny part of the law which no one really thought was very important, and it provided encouragement for non-utility companies to produce electricity and heat at the same time. And these companies would use small-scale technologies, small-scale steam turbines and gas turbines, which I'll talk about in a moment. And in the process of making electricity, they also produced a lot of waste heat. And the deal here was that if you as a company use that waste heat for industrial processes or for heating up greenhouses or anything else, then you would be allowed to sell your excess electricity to a utility company, and the utility company would be required to buy that electricity at pretty favorable rates for the generator and use that electricity and send it on the grid to all other customers. Well, the unintentional impact of this law was to encourage a lot of cogeneration. That's what this process is called, of making electricity and steam. And the beauty of it, of course, is that you can get double duty out of your energy expenditures. So out of your 1 pound of coal, let's say, you take 33% of that and you use and you make electricity out of that, and then you have another 10 or 15% of that coal that becomes heat, and that is used for industrial purposes as well. Therefore, you would get 40 to 50% energy output, useful energy output, out of your initial fuel input. Well, that's a lot better than electric utilities did. They were getting about 33 to 40% fuel efficiency. So this part of the law was designed to increase overall energy efficiency in the American economy. And with the incentives that the federal government gave and several states gave, there was a big push for development of new technologies that could do this cogeneration. One of those technologies was renewable technology, and that actually is a whole bunch of technologies, including wind turbines. There was a huge development of wind turbine technology, especially out in California, lots of research and development. And over the 80s, you saw the price of the cost of producing energy with wind turbines drop from about 20 cents per kilowatt hour to about 5 cents per kilowatt hour. And that made the electricity from wind turbines become competitive with conventionally generated electricity out in California and in a few other places. These incentives also helped spur the development of gas turbine cogeneration. Basically, a gas turbine is a jet engine. It uses natural gas. And these things improved dramatically during the 80s and 90s and produced electricity relatively cheaply, as well as steam or heat that could be used for industrial processes. Combining with these improvements in the technology, especially those that used natural gas, was the decline in the price of natural gas. Natural gas started to be deregulated as an industry in the 1980s, and as it was deregulated, there was a lot more exploration, a lot more natural gas was found, and the price of natural gas declined. So these cogenerating companies that were using natural gas turbine generators also, they saw their technology becoming cheaper and more efficient, and they saw the raw fuel input price go down as well. And in California and elsewhere, some of these companies were able to produce electricity for something like 3 cents per kilowatt hour, and that compared to 10 to 12 cents per kilowatt hour at some of the most expensive nuclear power plants. The reason all this is important is because in the regulated environment, the idea is that the natural monopoly utility can produce electricity more cheaply than can competitors, a bunch of competitors. But we're beginning to see, as a result of this law, a bunch of non-utility companies out there that can produce electricity for much cheaper than the utility could. And that made people think, hey, wait a minute, maybe the utility company isn't a natural monopoly after all, because, of course, these other companies are producing electricity cheaper. And if it's not a natural monopoly, then why are we regulating it in the first place? So that was sort of an intellectual, academic, and sometimes political rationale for getting rid of regulation.
Yeah. I know that we tend to think of deregulation as being a Republican sort of enthusiasm, and perhaps the golden age of deregulation having been the Reagan years. But certainly this movement did begin under President Carter and then really continued under Reagan and Bush. And I think that it was during the Bush administration that the big significant effort to deregulate utilities came. And maybe one of the first things, or maybe one of the important things that happened here was the opening up of the grid in the respect that now, instead of just it being a completely closed system, that is, you know, my local power company supplied me with power over their lines and nobody else could have access to the lines, now what the government was saying is that in fact they had to open that up so that theoretically, if I wanted to get my power from a company in, say, Indiana, the lines had to be made open so that then that electricity could come to me from Indiana rather than from whoever the local supplier that I had was. And then, of course, this gets us then. That's the step that you have to take so that you can get to the point where first we've seen big-time power users can get their power any place that they want. And then from there, the next step is for residential customers to be able to do the same thing. But for those things to happen, the grid had to open up.
That's right. I'm impressed. You're quite on top of these things, David. That's right. Let me just make one clarification.
Sure.
President Carter did not intend, I don't think, for the electric utility industry to become deregulated, but he was associated with deregulation in general. He, in fact, was the president who started airline deregulation, and he, in fact, did quite a bit for deregulation of also the natural gas and oil industries, too. It wasn't just the Reagan administration. But jumping ahead then about 10 years or so, you start seeing wholesale deregulation and wholesale competition in the electric utility industry, as you point out. That was partly a result of President George Bush's administration. When he came into office in 1989, he was disturbed that the United States was importing a huge amount of oil, even more oil on a percentage basis than we were importing back in 1973 when we had the first energy crisis. So he set up a committee to look at how we could reduce our dependence on foreign oil. Of course, other events motivated him even more to look into this matter. The Persian Gulf War, which ended in 1991, was in many people's view a war to make sure that the United States maintained its traditional supplies of oil abroad. But of course, what kind of oil policy is this if we have to go to war to protect our oil reserves or oil resources? And of course, they're not ours. We just depended on them a lot. So after the war, President Bush sent to Congress a National Energy Policy Act, which was only passed in 1992. It dealt mostly with oil and other resources, but there were provisions in there for electricity. By 1992, the American electric utility industry had moved away from the use of oil as a large energy resource, and instead of using oil, the industry was using coal. Well, even so, there were reasons to try to make the electric utility industry more efficient. And one way to do it, many people thought, was to introduce competition into the industry. After all, we had increased competition and deregulation in the telecommunications industry, in the trucking industry, railroad industry, airlines industry, securities industry, and on. And there were lots of efficiencies and lots of economic benefits to customers. So why not try this with electric utilities? The 1992 National Energy Policy Act allowed there for the first time to be wholesale competition so that companies could compete to sell electricity to the utilities, to the municipal utilities, to state authorities and the like. And this was supposed to be the first step in introducing competition into the electric utility industry. The second step would be competition on the retail basis, on the retail level, such that individual customers, whether they be large industrial customers like General Motors or individual homeowners, those customers could then make contracts with suppliers of electricity, with generators of electricity, whether it's the traditional utility or someone else. Now, the 1992 law did not authorize retail competition, but it did allow the states to decide whether they wanted to introduce retail competition within the states. And by 1993-94, you start seeing states studying the possibility of introducing competition on the retail level. By 1996, you have a couple of states passing laws allowing for retail deregulation. California was not the first state, but it was one of the states in September 1996 that passed a deregulation law, and open competition on the retail level started in March of 1998 in California. So that brings us up to the beginnings of real competitive retail deregulation.
We're at the point here where have just about 20 minutes left in the program, and we have a caller. I want to get them in, and we'll continue to talk about the subject. And I want to again introduce our guest. We're speaking with Richard Hirsch. He's professor of history and science and technology studies at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, and his research specialty is this very topic we're talking about here: deregulation of the American electric utility system. He's written quite a bit on the subject, including the book that I mentioned, Power Loss, which is published by the MIT Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-WILL. So 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Here's a caller in, I believe, in Urbana on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Very intensely informative show today. I was wondering if your guest had much to say about the potential impact of deregulation as far as environmental issues. And I had a couple questions first, though, more specific questions. One is, I read in the New Scientist a while back that they were arguing that hydroelectric dams are actually very anti-environmental, are not very environmentally friendly, that apparently the stagnant water that they produce give off a lot of carbon dioxide and methane, and so they're very, it's 20 times as potent the greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide, methane that is. And the decaying vegetation, apparently related to dams, makes them very environmentally unfriendly. And the other thing I was wondering is, again, in a kind of an environmental angle, is I saw a graph by the World Watch Institute, which showed that wind energy capacity in the rest of the world has been going up almost exponentially, and whereas it's been very flat in the U.S., and I was wondering if you could say a word or two about how the rest of the world is managing to accommodate wind energy. You know, I understand there's a lot of noise involved and people don't like the looks of it, and I was just curious if you could say a couple words about that. But in general, what I'm looking for is a little bit of information about what you think the impact deregulation would be environmentally, and I guess I'll hang up.
Okay, thanks for the call. Well, I do believe that is something that you've, Professor Hirsch, you have written on and looked at.
Sure, I can talk generally about a couple of these issues. A lot of environmental advocates were concerned that deregulation would reduce incentives for energy efficiency, renewable energy systems, and the like. The reason for that is because under a regulated environment, the regulators required utilities often to do research on wind turbines, for example, solar photovoltaics and other things like that. And the utilities did that partly because they knew they could recover their costs from the customers, and partly because it looked good for them and that was fine. When the industry started deregulating, of course, utility companies wanted to reduce their costs as much as possible so that they could sell electricity more competitively. And in this rush to deregulate, many utilities got rid of their efforts to do energy efficiency and renewable energy. Now, in California and elsewhere, the legislation has been written to try to compensate for that, but from friends in California, I'm told they didn't do a wonderful job there. So energy efficiency and renewable energy sort of went by the wayside, at least to a certain degree. As far as wind turbines go, here's a technology that is looking extremely good right now, especially in California. The price for the cost of generating electricity with wind turbines is between 3 and 5 cents per kilowatt hour. And of course, because there's no fuel expense, that price or that cost is fairly fixed. And therefore, if you are a utility company, it wouldn't hurt to have a good chunk of wind capacity at your disposal. You're hedging against price increases or cost increases in the future. Other countries have picked up on wind turbine technology a lot more than the United States. Those incentives that I told you about as a result of PURPA basically ended in the mid to late 1980s, and they weren't renewed. The 1992 National Energy Policy Act did have some incentives for wind, but many of the wind companies in the United States went under in the late 80s and 90s. In other countries, such as Denmark, the government provides lots of incentives, and some of the biggest and most successful wind turbine companies, do exist in Denmark. And they, of course, export to the United States and elsewhere. The wind business in the United States, at least, is very dependent on the cost of energy, so that when traditional energy supplies like coal and oil and natural gas go up in price, then wind turbine companies have a competitive advantage. But until about a year ago, natural gas prices were low enough so that in California and elsewhere, the natural gas burning gas turbine companies or companies that used gas turbines were able to produce for less than the cost of wind energy. I think you may see wind becoming a lot more popular in the United States. The wind resources, especially in the Midwest, are remarkable, and they are consistent, and they're just right for wind turbines. And you see in Minnesota and Iowa and elsewhere, companies building more and more wind farms. Some of the newer wind turbines are a bit less objectionable from an environmental point of view. Instead of building like 100 or even 1,000 relatively small wind turbines, the new design is for larger wind turbines with larger blades, and the blades don't turn as quickly, so that birds apparently have a better chance of avoiding being hit by the blades. So they may be becoming a lot more common, a lot more popular in the United States. I know that didn't answer all your questions there, but I hope it gave you a flavor of what might be coming in terms of wind, at least.
I want to make sure that before we find ourselves out of time, that I give you the chance to talk a little bit about what has been happening recently in California. As you certainly mentioned, California was not the first state to give consumers the opportunity to choose, but certainly because everybody was dealing with really the same issues, and I'm sure because California is so big, it is a natural case study. Mm-hmm. We have been hearing recently about all the difficulties they've been having, and people point the finger at deregulation.
Right.
Then some people say, well, no, it's not deregulation per se. It's the way that deregulation was handled, particularly the fact that the wholesale rates continue to be regulated, but the rates to individual consumers weren't. And then some people would say, well, no, it doesn't really even have anything to do with that at all. It has nothing to do with deregulation. When you look at the difficulties they've had there and the power shortages and rolling blackouts, what role has deregulation played in causing the difficulties they're having now?
That's, of course, the question of the hour. I think the problem is not that deregulation in principle is a bad thing, but that the deregulation in California missed a few points, and there were some problems there that were not necessarily imitated elsewhere. Currently, 24 states plus the District of Columbia that have deregulation laws on the books or revised regulations to essentially deregulate the retail side of the business. And many of the other states are not having the problems that California is having. It seems like the major problem in terms of the way that they restructured the system in California was that they allowed for wholesale competition and wholesale prices that could go anywhere they wanted, and yet the retail prices were fixed or capped. The legislation of 1996 required that the price of electricity to residential consumers, for example, go down by 10%, and they weren't allowed to go up until after the transition in 2002 had ended. Well, the problem there is that if demand goes up, and I'm sorry, if the wholesale price of electricity goes up and you can't pass those price increases on to customers, then the customers don't have the economic signals they need to cut back on consumption or to find more energy-efficient ways to use electricity, and therefore they'll just keep on using electricity as if there were no problems. Of course, the big problem is that wholesale prices in the California market have gone up dramatically to the extent of the utility companies buying electricity, let's say, at about 25 cents per kilowatt hour and selling it for 12 cents per kilowatt hour. If you do that for too long, you lose a lot of money. And indeed, the California utilities, or the two major utilities there, claim to have been losing about $12 billion, and that's a lot of money. You can't stay in business too long if you sell for less than your cost. But it seems like that fixed price, price for customers, was indeed one of the problems. You have, again, wholesale prices that can go anywhere, but customer prices that are fixed. And that, of course, inhibits good economic signals being given to customers. There are some other problems, too. There is some talk that the companies that are supplying electricity into the California grid may have been gaming a bit. They may have been withholding some electricity so that there would be some, so that the demand for electricity would be much higher than the supply, therefore the price would go up, and therefore they would be getting more money for the electricity that they eventually supplied. I can't speak authoritatively about that. One of the problems in California is that the market for selling electricity is pretty much kept in pretty much secret, so that the suppliers of electricity provide bids to the power exchange, but the power exchange doesn't necessarily provide all that information to the other bidders, and ultimately, you don't have a lot of information getting around. So people are working in the dark, and unfortunately, markets need information to work properly. So something's going to have to happen there. Another problem, too, with California was that the suppliers of electricity provided electricity to a spot market, to a market where people would buy the electricity on a day-to-day basis, pretty much. And they were not allowed to, the suppliers were not allowed to offer long-term contracts to utilities and customers. So a customer could not say, I'd like a certain amount of electricity for a year ahead of time, and I'm willing to pay you a certain amount, and that rate is fixed. By doing that, you can sort of hedge the price of electricity. If electricity goes way up in price, at least you have a fixed price for some of your electricity. That was not allowed. So there were a bunch of strange market mechanisms which everyone hoped would lead to lower price electricity, but in fact, this past summer and fall and now winter led to much higher prices.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sorry to say that we're at the end of the time. There's lots more we could discuss, and we're simply going to have to leave it there. Perhaps at some other time, particularly as we kind of see how things continue to go, we might come back and revisit the issue. But for the moment, we want to say to you, Professor Hirsch, thank you very much for giving us some of your time today.
My pleasure.
Our guest, Richard Hirsch, he is professor of history and science and technology studies at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. And if you're interested in exploring some of the background of the issue, you can look for his book, Power Loss, The Origins of Deregulation and Restructuring in the American Electric Utility System, published by the MIT Press.